Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Meredith, and to my left is Judge Toth. We're here today in the matter of Watson v. Shulkin, docket number 16-2035. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
James Heiberg on behalf of the Secretary, Your Honor.
Justin Elias on behalf of the Secretary.
Thank you.
Amy Odom, National Veterans Legal Services Program for the appellant. And with me at counsel table is Jill Davenport, also of National Veterans Legal Services Program.
Very good. Thank you all. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. From a procedural standpoint, I want the arguments to focus on the questions that we submitted to you in the order, the five questions in the supplemental briefing order, which would include under what circumstances is the claimant required to expressly raise the issue of an examiner's competence to the board? Number two, where a claimant did not raise the issue of an examiner's competence, but the board requested a particular type of examination or opinion, here an orthopedic neurologic examination, what, if any, are the board's duties with respect to assessing the competence of the examiner who provided the resulting opinion? For comparison purposes, how, if at all, are those duties different than in cases where the issue is expressly raised? Question number three, where the face of the examination report reveals that an examiner's specialty is in a different field than that associated with the type of examination requested by the board, here a cardiologist as opposed to an orthopedist or a neurologist, does that opinion show some irregularity that prevents the presumption of competence from attaching and raises the issue of the examiner's competence? We reference the Wise decision, 26 Vet App at 526, such that a claimant is relieved of the obligation to expressly raise the issue. Number four, what is the effect of the VA Adjudication Procedurals Manual, M21-1, Part 3, Subchapter 4, which instructs VA staff to request a specialist examination only if it is considered essential for rating purposes, and explains that, for example, a specialist examination may be requested if an issue is unusually complex, if there are conflicting opinions or diagnosis that must be reconciled or based on a board remand? And number five, what is the VA's usual process for selecting an examiner to perform a compensation and pension examination or provide a medical opinion? Obviously, some of these matters may overlap, but I certainly intend my questions to follow that general order. And my colleagues may have other questions as well. Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. We reserve 7 minutes.
7 minutes. Okay. So noted. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Thank you, Chief Judge, for your clarification of the issues that you would like to discuss today. We're prepared to discuss these issues, but I do want to point out that if the Court agrees with us on the first argument raised in our brief, which is that the evidence reasonably raised the issue of presumptive service connection under 3.303B, the Court doesn't even need to get to the question of whether Mr. Watson was required in this case to raise an objection before the agency, because the need for medical opinion evidence is negated. But turning specifically to our alternative argument that the board erred in denying direct service connection by without addressing the competency of the cardiologist to render a nexus opinion about the spine, it's important to also remember, as the court's order indicated or implied, that the question in this case isn't really whether the cardiologist was competent. That's an outstanding factual inquiry for the board to address on remand. The question is simply whether Mr. Watson is precluded from raising this argument before the court because he failed to raise any objection at the agency. And the case law supports the conclusion that Mr. Watson was not required to raise any objection in this case. First, the board had an affirmative duty under this court's holding in Stigall versus West to ensure that the regional office substantially complied with its remand order that specifically requested an opinion, a neurological or orthopedic examination. And this is regardless of whether the application of VA examiner's competency applies. But even if we don't prevail on Stigall, the court should still conclude that Mr. Watson wasn't required to raise any objection before the agency because under the facts of this case, the presumption of examiner's competency doesn't apply.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt you, but so is it your position that to comply with Stigall that a specialist would have been required in this case to conduct that examination?
It's our position that it's possible, but the board has to make the finding in the first instance as to whether the report that was returned to the board, signed by a cardiologist, substantially complied with its specific request for an orthopedic or neurological exam. Here, the board didn't address the issue at all. Of course, it's possible that the board could find on remand if the proper evidence is associated with the claims file and Mr. Watson is provided the opportunity to respond, that even though this particular examiner's specialty was in cardiology, this examiner had the requisite training or experience and followed the required protocol sufficient to render the type of opinion and provide the type of exam that the board specifically requested. But it's important here that the board didn't address this at all. It just simply went to decide the merits of the direct service connection theory without addressing the issue of whether an exam conducted by a cardiologist satisfied its request for an exam, a neurological or an orthopedic exam. And under Stigall, if we frame the issue that way, there's no need for Mr. Watson to have raised any objection to the agency because this isn't really about the examiner's competency. It's about the board's duty to ensure compliance with its remand order and to honor Mr. Watson's right under Stigall to compliance with that remand order. And since it's not about competency, the presumption of competency doesn't have any place in the analysis, which means that the issue of whether Mr. Watson was required to raise an objection doesn't have any place in the analysis.
Counsel, this presumption of competency, is it a presumption that's grounded on law, to your knowledge?
It's my opinion that it's not. As we indicated in our supplemental memorandum, we agree with Judge Reyna and Justice Gorsuch in that there's no regulatory, statutory, or even factual basis for the presumption of competency. It seems to have come out of Cox, which didn't cite any type of underlying facts or any regulatory or statutory authority for a presumption of of an examiner's competency.
Counsel, let's assume for a moment that everybody in this room agrees with Justice Gorsuch and Sotomayor and Judge Reyna. What's the avenue that we can, I mean, we still have a binding Federal Circuit case that's also binding on everyone in this room. Is it merely, are you saying it's only through WISE, through sort of an expansion of WISE or interpretation of WISE, or is there another avenue that could sort of get us to the result that you want here?
Well, obviously the court is bound by its own panel decisions, such as Cox, and the Federal Circuit's decisions, such as Bastien, Rizzo, and Parks. So for the time being, the presumption of VA examiner's competency applies. But in this case, it doesn't apply. While the presumption is, in fact, is applicable maybe to some other cases based on precedent from this court and the Federal Circuit, the court can and should find in this case that it doesn't apply because of the circumstances. First, the board remand order that specifically requested a type of examination, and because the facts of the case fit into Wise, in that by signing the exam as, and noting his qualifications as a cardiologist, there created some sort of indication of irregularity in the process of selecting this particular VA examiner. And thirdly, because since the examiner affirmatively offered proof of his qualifications, the presumption doesn't apply. The purpose of the presumption, as the Federal Circuit explained in Rizzo, is to protect the VA from having to affirmatively prove the qualifications of an examiner in every case. But if the evidence about the examiner's qualification is already in the record, then what purpose does the presumption serve? In this case, the evidence of the doctor's qualifications as a cardiologist is already in the record. So there really is no purpose for the presumption to serve, and therefore it doesn't apply.
So, counsel, is your position that because the evidence in the record indicates that the doctor is a cardiologist and not an orthopedic doctor, that then on its face the doctor is not competent to offer an opinion on an orthopedic situation?
No, we wouldn't go that far to say that the examiner is clearly not competent. It's our position that that's an outstanding factual determination that the board has to make in the first instance. It's simply our position that the fact that this exam was signed by a cardiologist and had to do with a spinal disease, an especially complicated issue of nexus between spinal arthritis and a possible diagnosis from 1969 and or an in-service injury in 1967, that raised the question or indicated some irregularity in VA's process of selecting a cardiologist to render this type of opinion. And therefore, on the record itself, the board had an obligation to address the issue of the veteran's, or excuse me, of the examiner's competency, and it failed to do so in this case.
So how, under your analysis, if a doctor just signed the report MD and given no indication of any specialty in any specific field, would that sort of change the analysis?
Yes. In that case, because there isn't any evidence in the record to question that particular examiner's qualifications, it would be incumbent upon the claimant under the current case law to raise an objection.
Can I go back a minute and clarify? So in this case, you're not suggesting that the board was requiring a particular specialist provide this examination. It was just a request for an orthopedic examination, not that it be provided by an orthopedic specialist.
It's unclear from the record whether the board actually required that it be conducted by a specialist with experience and training in orthopedics or neurology, or just a specific type of examination. But our position is that lack of clarity is precisely why the board was required to address that issue. Now, if the board had specifically required an examination by a particular specialist, I'm not sure we would be here today. I think that the case law is pretty clear, or at least strongly indicates that in that type of situation, there is no question about whether a veteran needs...
Right, but so if it had been dental or visual or psychiatric, something, you know, recognized as requiring a specialist, that might... sort of issue, but or if it had just been a general, you know, conduct examination on this person. Are you suggesting that any remand order that identifies any particular type of examination automatically would sort of require a specialist in that field to comply with the remand order?
No, we're not suggesting. We don't go that far. We are just arguing that in that situation, the board has an obligation under Stigall and 7104D1 to provide an adequate statement of reasons or bases as to whether it's there was substantial compliance with its remand order.
So the board would then have a duty just to follow on afterwards in its decision, okay, you know, we assigned this examination a specific type and then a different, specialty doctor did it. So they would sua sponte have to do a little bit of competency analysis on that doctor.
That's right, in the absence of even an objection from the claimant, which in many cases will include having to associate evidence with the claims file about that particular examiner's background and qualifications, which is there is no such evidence in the record in this case. And the board would also have to give the claimant adequate opportunity to respond to that evidence.
How would that go ahead.
So in this case, what the board said was to provide an orthopedic examination. And under the manual M21-1, Part 3, Subpart 4, Chapter 3, Section A, it talks about under what circumstances a specialty examination is required to be provided by a specialist. And this is not one of the conditions that are listed. In fact, it says that usually a specialty exam will be performed by a non-specialist. So are you suggesting that this is outside the normal process of VA's selection of an examiner, that they chose someone who is not a specialist in that field?
I'm going to try to rephrase the question, and please tell me if I'm misunderstanding. I think the question is, since the M21 says that most examinations are not conducted by specialists,
is that their normal process? Or not? It would be normal for someone who's not a specialist in that field to provide the examination.
Well, I have a two-part answer to that question. The first answer is that although we didn't discuss it in the briefs, the Federal Circuit recently made clear that the M21 is not binding on the board, and that's in DAV versus Shulkin. And the M21 also makes clear that when the board requests a specific type of examination, the regional office must comply with that request. So I would say that the M21 doesn't really factor into the Stigall analysis here, except to support the concept that under Stigall there's a right to compliance with the board request.
But on the issue of whether selecting a cardiologist raised an appearance of irregularity, is it your understanding from these manual provisions that VA's normal process would not be to get a specialist in this type of examination?
Can you tell me what's the citation again?
Part 3, Subpart 4, Chapter 3, Section A1G. And H. They distinguish between a specialty examination and an examination performed by a specialist. And it says that generally a specialty exam, they're not going to require a specialist to perform it.
Well, I would respond the way that we did in our supplemental memorandum, which is to say the M21 does not provide any type of regular, consistent VA practice in terms of when to select a specialist and when not to. And we would point specifically to Part 3, Subchapter 4, 3A6C, that says that the regional office should request a specialist examination only if it is considered essential for rating purposes, and then says a specialist examination may be requested if an issue is unusually complex, if there are conflicting opinions or diagnoses that must be reconciled, or based on a BVA remand. So the first two situations are pretty discretionary in terms of how much discretion the VA adjudicator at the regional office has to determine when a specialist examination is required. And therefore, it can't be said that this is a regular and consistent practice on behalf of the VA for when to select a specialist examination and when not to. And even Judge Meredith, in the section that you've identified, it doesn't provide any specific criteria for when a specialist examination is required and when it's not. It just says that we usually won't request a specialist examination, but doesn't provide any information as to when, what is usual.
But there are other provisions in the manual that talk about situations that absolutely require a specialist to perform the examination, and this is not among that list. Hearing, vision, mental health.
That's right. So that section of the M21 that lists those sections may provide a consistent practice for those cases, but there is no consistent practice for any of the cases outside those situations except for when there's a BVA remand order.
Ms. Odom, there is a VHA directive, 1603, right, that discusses the certification requirements that physicians and health professionals normally go through, as I understand it, in order to provide examinations like this one. That would be, I believe, if I follow Judge Meredith's line of questioning, the general process that's in place at the VA. Are you familiar with that process?
Yes, we're talking about the directive that was attached to the Secretary's supplemental memorandum.
Yes.
Yes.
So is there, if the usual process is to require a health examiner to, or medical examiner to be certified before a certain type of examination can be provided, doesn't that answer the question of any irregularity?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree. The directive that's attached to the Secretary's supplemental memorandum only talks about what are the training processes for VA examiners. It doesn't talk about what's the process for selecting a VA examiner in a particular case. So it's, I would say that the VHA directive is totally irrelevant to the question before the court in this case. It might be relevant to the question of whether this cardiologist was actually competent, but again, that's an outstanding issue to be addressed by the board in the first instance and would also require record evidence of exactly what training this examiner went through. The VHA directive just talks about some sort of orthopedic training, but doesn't really discuss what's involved in that training, how long that training is, and how it turns an otherwise not competent examiner into a competent examiner.
Okay. So how do you challenge the expertise of an examiner? How would you start at the regional office or at the board?
Well, first,
are the doctor's qualifications available for you as a matter of course?
It is my experience that the qualifications aren't available as a matter of course. That's why this case is extraordinary in that the examiner did, sua sponte, provide evidence of his qualifications. And that's why this case falls outside the presumption of competence. It's my experience, although I must confess that I don't do a whole ton of agency work, most of my practice is before this court, but it's my experience that most of the time, the examiner wouldn't provide qualifications in the way that he did in this case. So in those cases, because of the current state of the case law, it is incumbent upon the veteran to request information, specific information about the veteran, the examiner's qualifications. And depending on what those qualifications are, perhaps raise an objection. So let me explain. For example, if we had a case where an examiner conducted, say, an orthopedic examination, and then the claimant requested evidence of the examiner's qualifications, and we found that the examiner was a podiatrist who didn't have any training expertise qualifications in joint diseases or injuries of anything other than the feet, then I don't believe that it's incumbent upon the claimant to make an objection, because the evidence is already in there that raises some indication of irregularity. However, if the CV were returned and it turned out that the examiner had many years of experience in orthopedic medicine related to the entire orthopedic system, then it would be incumbent upon the claimant to raise some sort of objection to why that's not sufficient, why that renders that particular examiner incompetent to render the orthopedic opinion in that claimant's case.
In terms of the presumption of competence, I mean, obviously it's an all or nothing proposition. Somebody's either an expert in a field or the other testimony is lay testimony, and they give it kind of whatever weight. Does this inform any way in terms of the probative value? I mean, we sort of put the competency aside. If you were to say, listen, if this, exam were done by an orthopedic specialist, it would obviously have the fullest probative value. Here it's done by, a cardiologist, so you have to take that. And instead of just being sort of an all or nothing presumption of competence, it would just generally inform the probative, the credibility of the determination made.
Sure.
You could still, in a sense, raise it, but in a sort of different form for a slightly different purpose.
Yes, in many cases, I think that would be the approach to take, especially if there is a favorable medical opinion by a more qualified private examiner or even a more qualified VA examiner. Or, for instance, in this case, the cardiologist said a couple times it would be difficult to attach. It would be difficult to say this. It would be difficult to render this favorable opinion. And that raises some question of whether it's difficult for that particular examiner because he doesn't have the expertise in spinal diseases, or if it's because of the state of the evidence.
Counsel, I see your time's about to expire, but I have another question, and my colleagues may have more, too. So could you add 3 minutes, please?
Yeah, I wanted to know, Chief, quickly, because I don't want to barge in. I do want to, at some point, address some sort of your reasons and basis argument, and then I want to do so as to give the Secretary, the opportunity to respond to whatever you say. But I don't want to kind of sidetrack us.
Okay.
Until we sort of fully exhausted.
Could you add 7 minutes? I'm sorry. Thank you. In building on Wise, Ms. Odom, are you suggesting then that whenever on the face of, let's say, the qualifications of the doctor, a request has been made for a certain type of an examination, like an orthopedic examination, but it's done by a cardiologist, that is enough to raise a question of irregularity?
Yes, that's our position. We believe that by listing his qualifications as a cardiologist, the examiner was essentially saying what the examiner said in Wise, which is that I don't have formal training or background in orthopedics or neurology other than the rudimentary month-long orthopedics or neurology rotation in medical school, and it's enough to raise the question or the appearance of irregularity.
But the Directive 1603 also talks about certification training that a general physician would have beyond the rotation in medical school.
Right, but that would be something for the board to address in the first instance, right, and make the determination, the factual determination, as to whether despite lacking the formal education or training or specialty in orthopedics or neurology, this person did have requisite experience by virtue of the VA training.
Okay. Can I go back to your comment about Wise? In Wise, there was explicit evidence that that examiner may not have had the education, training, or experience to provide the examination in question. In this case, is there anything explicit that shows that this examiner might not have had education, background, or training to provide this exam? Or are you asking us to draw an inference from his specialty, cardiologist, that he wouldn't?
we are saying that by listing the qualifications as cardiologists, the examiner was explicitly providing information to the agency and to this court that that examiner's specialty was somewhere other than orthopedics and neurology.
So why, in your view, would knowing the doctor's current specialty rule out the possibility that they had no training, background, experience in other areas, or even raise the inference that they don't?
Well, so we don't think we have to prove or rule out the fact that this person might have had other training or experience, but we think, to use your word, is that, Judge Mary, this is at least a very strong inference that this person has spent his career treating or evaluating diseases and injuries of the heart, not diseases and injuries of the orthopedic system, especially the spine.
But, and you think you could still draw that inference in light of the VHA directive that Chief Judge Davis was talking about that suggests that someone would have undergone training specifically in spinal examinations before giving this type of an examination?
Yes, because the VHA directive doesn't explain what training, what type of training this examiner had, except or could have had, because there's no record evidence that the examiner actually underwent this training. Specifically, how long the training was, what did the training cover? I mean, if it's just a multiple choice computer program, that might not be sufficient. That's something for the board to address in the first instance in light of the examiner's qualifications as a cardiologist.
Well, there is a provision in there, counsel, section 3 under the policy that of 1603 that says it's VHA policy that all clinicians designated to conduct VA disability evaluations must complete the required training modules and post-tests and become certified by the DMA. New clinicians must be certified prior to being allowed to perform any VA disability evaluation. So I think I understand your point about there are some factual issues that need to be addressed by the board, but there does seem to be a process in place for training and certification. I guess the question here is whether or not that was met, was one of the questions.
Right. So we don't dispute that the VA has a training process for VA examiners and that the VHA directive establishes that. But in this case, we're looking specifically at whether the specific examiner who listed his qualifications as a cardiologist raised some indication of irregularity that the regional office chose this specialist to render an opinion about orthopedics and neurology. It could be that on remand, with the proper evidence associated with the record and Mr. Watson being given the opportunity to respond, that the answer to that question is yes. But it's our position that the board was required to address this question even without a specific objection from Mr. Watson.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about your reasons and basis argument. I just want to make sure I understand it correctly in terms of kind of walking through the steps. Sort of following the framework outlined in Walker, right, you've latched onto the sort of second route that Walker identifies, and it's basically where you have a disputed diagnosis, I forget the exact phrasing, and then that would sort of, in a sense, trigger a line of analysis under 303B, and I just wanted to follow your argument in terms of how that is demonstrated and where the board's opinion would have been lacking.
Okay.
If you just sort of walk us through.
Sure. Well, the first problem is that the board didn't even cite 3.303B, much less make the necessary.
But it does, on page, I think it's on, I don't know, do you have the board's decision in front of you?
I do.
Okay. The fifth page, it appears to me, right, they, that's that middle paragraph, mm-hmm. second paragraph under analysis. So they lay out, the framework of 303B, and they don't cite Walker, but they say Clyburn. They identify basically how continuity of symptomology would have been established, in a sense, with a disputed diagnosis.
Right. So I retract the statement that they didn't cite it, but they did only in the boilerplate. There's no mention of 3.30B in the actual analysis.
Certainly. No, you're right about that. So it looks to me like page 9 and 10, they kind of get into the meat of the matter. And what I'm interested less in is if they, you know, it's a form that they mention, is whether they actually, in a sense, departed from the framework. And again, I mean, Walker's not, you know, the reg controls, but whether the framework sort of outlined in terms of what, who would have to prove what, and, you know, whether the veteran has proved continuity of symptomology, and whether that would, in a sense, kind of shift a presumption to show some intercurrent cause. Can you just, I mean, I just want to make sure I understand your argument.
Sure, absolutely.
Before you respond, counsel, could you add 3 more minutes, please?
Thank you.
No problem.
So it's undisputed in this case that we have 2 of the 3 elements, right? We have the current disability of arthritis, which is the chronic disability under 3.309A, so therefore under Walker, 3.303B applies. There's also no dispute that there was a notation of arthritis within a year of discharge. It seems that the dispute is on whether there's continuity of symptomatology. But as we pointed out in our brief, there is lay evidence of continuity of symptomatology, and that triggered the board's duty to address the competency and credibility of that evidence, which it didn't do.
It doesn't, I mean, it, you know, on page 10, that mm-hmm. sort of second paragraph, I mean, they do sort of nexus analysis, which would be, you know, the required analysis under the sort of second route is basically, you know, now if you don't fit under the first route, you know, now the veteran now has to demonstrate a nexus. And so they do the analysis, at least some analysis on it.
I would disagree with you there, Judge. Mm-hmm. And that's because
how so?
Under 3.303B, it's the proven evidence of continuity of symptomatology that provides the nexus. Medical nexus opinion evidence isn't necessary under Walker. So
in this case, the contention would be the 69 exam and his lay statements essentially establish the continuity of symptomology?
That's right. So long as it's competent and credible evidence of continuity of symptomatology. I don't think there can be any true debate that he's competent to talk about back pain. And the secretary in his brief provided many post hoc rationalizations as to why perhaps the board could have found Mr. Watson to be not credible, but none of those were actually findings made by the board and, in fact, are not supported by the record or the law. For example,
I mean, but I just want to make sure. Your argument is he's established through this evidence the continuity of symptomology. And it seems the board's saying he did not establish through this evidence the continuity of symptomology. I mean, that's essentially the flashpoint that we would be, you know, that we would be looking at here is as to whether or not this continuity has in fact been established. Because the presumption now wouldn't apply, so he would have to establish that continuity, right?
I again disagree with that the board made a finding that he didn't establish the continuity of symptomatology. The board only went through whether there was a medical nexus opinion supporting service connection, direct service connection under 3.303D for a disease diagnosed after service. But in order to have satisfied its reasons or basis requirement with respect to continuity of symptomatology, the board would have had to have actually addressed the lay evidence of continuity of symptomatology and made a determination as to whether it's competent and credible. And if it's I see my time has expired. May I just finish this point? If it's competent and credible, that's all you need under Walker. And so that's also why we wanted to emphasize that if you agree with us on that, if the court agrees with us on that point, there's no need to get into whether Mr. Watson had an obligation to raise an objection as to the competency of the VA examiner's medical opinion evidence isn't required under Walker. Thank you.
Mr. Heiberg?
May it please the court. The court should affirm the board's March 24, 2016 decision because a claimant must expressly raise the issue of the examiner's competence before the board in all circumstances to rebut the presumption of competency that VA has chosen a qualified examiner, and that has been established by the Federal Circuit in the Rizzo line of cases. Rizzo holds that where a veteran does not challenge a VA medical expert's competence or qualifications before the board, VA need not affirmatively establish that expert's competency. And that rationale continues through with Bastian, Sickles, and Parks, all emphasizing that the objection must be made. Further, even in Parks, it indicates that where an appellant is pro se, he must make the objection.
Mr. Heiberg, I have a question for you, but before I do, I need to let you know that we added 10 minutes to appellant's time. If you need additional time, you'll have that amount as well.
Thank you.
Okay. And my question is, on the face of the examiner's qualifications, if it is is not consistent with the request from the VA for an orthopedic examination, and his qualifications indicate he's a heart specialist, does that not raise an issue of irregularity?
Well, Your Honor, I think this case can be distinguished from Wise in the sense that in that case you had an examiner expressly raise at issue her qualifications.
Right.
Here, the examiner indicated cardiologist, but certainly that doctor was also a general practitioner prior to becoming a specialist, so had all the requisite medical training as a physician, and certainly through both Cox and Parks, one doesn't even have to be an MD to be a qualified medical examiner. Where in both those cases, you had nurse practitioners.
Well, you understand this presumption of competence and the underlying basis of Cox and Rizzo and Bastian is really under attack by the Supreme Court and the Federal Circuit.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. But there's still not a majority to overrule that presumption. It still is, of course, the binding case law.
Not yet. That's correct. Is there, to your knowledge, is the department looking at this issue at all?
Yes, my understanding is after the Mathis decision, there have been internal discussions about ways in which information could be more readily made available to appellants through inquiries, whether that be through FOIA requests or through somewhat redacted information that would not contain personal information for the examiners to be made available online so that it can be seen. But there's been no definitive decision on that, as to my knowledge at this time.
I see. Thank you.
But as mentioned, this is not a case where you have the examiner expressly calling into question his own competence. And as also mentioned, the issue here is really whether the examiner has the education, training, or experience to offer a medical diagnosis, statements, or opinions as required by 38 CFR 3.159A1. And as what Parks mentioned, it's not the job title or the description, it's the process. And so the issue here is whether the person has the proper training. Separate and apart from the presumption of competence, you do have the issues with the DMA directive, where anybody who's doing these examinations is going to have prerequisite training for basic examinations, plus, in this case, there would be a musculoskeletal examination module that would need to be completed in training. But that's a separate issue from the presumption of competence, at least in terms of the presumption of competence. The physician's medical training simply is a medical doctor is sufficient to ensure a certain level of competence to provide the examinations.
Mr. Heiberg, you've touched on one of the questions that I had and one of the questions in the supplemental briefing order, which is number 5, on the usual process. And I referenced the DMA Directive 1603 earlier with appellant's counsel. That does provide some specific requirements for certification, to your knowledge?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Okay.
As I said, there's a basic, I think, 5 prerequisite courses that every examiner must take, complete, and pass successfully. And then for additional types of examinations, and I said the one that would be relevant to this case with the musculoskeletal examination, would also need to be passed. And occasionally, I think these requirements change and that the examiners will need to keep updated as to their qualifications. But that is a provision, basically, that ensures that the people doing the medical examinations are qualified to do so. And it essentially gets to the issue that was presented in the reply brief in terms of the hypothetical questions posed, where you're not going to have somebody who has completely no nexus to the type of examination being performed doing them. The people doing the examinations are going to have completed the requisite requirements in order to do the examinations to which they've been tasked.
So that leads me to my next question, and also question number five regarding the process for selecting an examiner. You articulated this in your response to the supplemental order, but could you briefly discuss or outline, if you will, what the usual process is for selecting an examiner to perform a compensation and pension examination or provide a medical opinion?
I think the examination request is going to go out through the ERA system, the examination request routing assistant, and that will go to VHA, and that will determine in terms of geographical area as to where the veteran lives, you know, what's an appropriate facility, and then also as to what qualified examiners are in that area. And each facility is going to be governed slightly differently, but the on-site CMP manager has broad discretion as to how to handle his or her staff and how these examinations are going to be assigned. But essentially, they see what comes in terms of the requested examination and assign it accordingly to an examiner who has the appropriate level of training.
Could a CMP manager assign an examination request to someone who did not have the appropriate level of training?
They would not do so. I mean, theoretically, I suppose it's possible. That would not be a violation of basically the policies in terms of who is supposed to be assigned an examination. All examiners are supposed to be qualified to do the examinations to which they've been tasked. If you have a CMP manager assign somebody who's not qualified, that certainly raises an issue.
Or not certified. Let's say the cardiologist was not certified to do musculoskeletal examinations. Is that a possibility?
That very well could be. Certainly the board is not going to know about this level of information, but at least in terms of the CMP examiner assigning the examination, the CMP examiner is not so concerned about whether the physician indicates MD or cardiologist. The important thing to the examiner is whether this person has completed the requisite training to do the type of examination that has been ordered.
So if an MD is a cardiologist, let's say, and this CMP direct on-site manager is looking at the qualifications, before that person could be assigned an examination, there would need to be a certification, osteopathic examination. There need to be a osteopathic certification by this MD.
Well, whoever the examiner is would have needed to have completed the musculoskeletal examination right. module in order to do that examination.
Okay. Thank you.
In terms of the issue presented by Wise in terms of irregularity, I think this case is, the facts are very similar to what was presented in Parks, where you had an advanced registered nurse practitioner with a family medicine background providing an examination regarding the cause of diabetes. That's a case where you have somebody's qualifications that don't necessarily on a surface level match the type of examination being performed. But certainly the court in Parks indicated that, well, the objection still must be made. The case can be distinguished from this one in the sense that the appellant in Parks did not know that the nurse was had a family medicine background at the time that learned it later, whereas here the issue of the examiner's notation as cardiologist was known, and actually that would have created essentially a greater incentive to object as required by the Rizzo line of cases. But in its discussion in Wise, the court basically went through the fact pattern of these cases and indicated that such a situation where an advanced registered nurse practitioner in family medicine doing a diabetes exam did not raise the issue of irregularity, which, again, is analogous to this case where you have a cardiologist doing a spine examination.
Counsel, is it basically the Secretary's position that absent some type of self-disclosure, you know, like in Wise, where the examiner just says, look, I'm not really competent in this field, but there's no other fact pattern that would really sort of trigger the irregularity?
Your Honor, there could be. And I think probably the best example might be in terms of the M21 specifically states that hearing, vision, dental, and psychiatric examinations are to be conducted by a specialist. If you had a situation where that did not happen, I also believe that TBI examinations are also done by specialists. But if you had a situation there where you had an examination that's supposed to be done by a specialist not done by one, I think that creates a wise issue and certainly would trigger an issue internally as well in terms of the examination not being done in accordance with the M21.
Counsel, you indicated that the appellant could object on the qualifications, but looking at Justice Gorsuch's dissent from the denial of certiorari in the Mathis case at the Supreme Court, let me just quote a little bit. I'd like to get your response to this. Justice Gorsuch asks, but where does this presumption come from? It enjoys no apparent provenance in the relevant statutes. There, Congress imposed on the VA an affirmative duty to assist, not to impair, veterans seeking evidence for their disability claims. And then he goes on, and consider how the presumption works in practice. The VA usually refuses to supply information that might allow a veteran to challenge the presumption without an order from the Board of Veterans' Appeals. And that board often won't issue an order unless the veteran can first supply a specific reason for thinking the examiner incompetent. No doubt this arrangement makes the VA's job easier, but how is that an administrative agency may manufacture for itself or win from the courts a regime that has no basis in the relevant statutes and does nothing to assist and much to impair the interests of those the law says the agency is supposed to serve? I mean, it seems to me that Justice Gorsuch is suggesting that the appellant is in a catch-22. He doesn't get the information on the qualifications of the examiner and yet is expected to object and raise some issues of incompetence without knowing what the examiner's qualifications are.
Well, Your Honor, certainly, at least in terms of the establishment of the presumption, of course, it comes from Rizzo. In terms of some of the other objections referenced in Justice Gorsuch's opinion there, some of it echoes, I think, what Judge Reyna had stated in his dissent in the Federal Circuit decision, which was also addressed by Judge Hughes, indicating that getting an order to provide the documentation, I think, is a reference to the Knorr decision. And Judge Hughes said that, well, that's one incident that doesn't necessarily, create an ironclad rule. So certainly with Knorr, production of the CV in that case was pertinent to getting to the issue of the qualifications of the examiner. We would simply disagree with Justice Gorsuch's take on this, that it's that restrictive. Certainly, again, as mentioned, in light of the Mathis decision, there have been some discussions about what can happen to make this easier for veterans to obtain this information when they object, or make this information available to them in such a way that they don't necessarily have to object to get it. But that goes more towards a policy than the presumption itself.
If I could jump in there. So do you think that at a minimum it would appear confusing to a veteran or irregular to a veteran to receive an opinion about his spine from a cardiologist with no explanation from VA as to why that practitioner is qualified to render that opinion? And is that consistent with a system that's supposed to be veteran-friendly?
It very well could, Your Honor. But and I think it goes more towards to what how definite the objection might be in terms of the qualifications. Or if you had a veteran say, how is this person competent to do my examination? That's probably sufficient to rebut the presumption right there. But in the absence of any sort of objection, the board isn't to know, and they presume that the qualifications of the examiner. So, yes, certainly a situation like that could raise the question very easily, especially for someone who would be a pro se appellant, but they must raise the question. I mean, once raised, then the issue then becomes how can it best be utilized to provide that information to the veteran so that they can make use of it as they need to. I do want to address the issue in terms of Stigall, where here there is a difference between the specialty examination, which goes towards the type of examination, versus a specialist, which goes to the qualifications of the examiner. The case was remanded in April 2014. It was for an orthopedic neurological examination of appellant's neck and back. So it's a specialty examination. It goes towards the type of examination. The remand order did not request a specialist. And then when it was remanded again in June 2015 for an addendum opinion, the court specifically ordered that it go back to the same examiner or similarly qualified examiner. So, and again, did not request a specialist opinion. So we don't believe there's any issue here with a Stigall problem, and that the remand was fully complied with. And there was a distinction here between the specialty examination and a specialist examination, which would not have been at issue here because it does not go towards the dental vision, hearing, or psychiatric. Another issue, appellant has argued that the examiner puts his or her qualifications at issue simply by indicating cardiologist. But the M21 at Part 3, Subpart 4, Chapter 3, D2B requires that every examiner provide signature and qualifications. So under that line of argument, essentially, the presumption of competency is defeated simply by signing your name and putting a title, which I simply don't see as being an accurate reading of the presumption of competency. Unless there are further questions.
I want to ask you one question. You know, when I was counsel, I hated hypotheticals. I did an appellate argument, and I'm going to sort of break my rule and give you one. But in this case, say in 2002, when he got private doctors looked at him, if they'd been orthopedic specialists and, you know, say he gets two opinions from them and they say, hey, look, we looked at his 1969 records and we think he had arthritis for 19 different reasons. They sort of match, again, it's hypothetical, match that against a cardiologist looking at it, you know, looking at the same records. Would that have essentially implicated irregularity, or would that have raised the competency issue? Because you're looking at a qualitative judgment from doctors of varying degrees of specialization.
I think, Your Honor, the issue of competency is going to allow the doctor essentially to get in the door with his or her medical opinion.
Right.
And this also sort of cuts both ways. We've got a private physician that nobody's really questioning their competency off the bat either.
Right.
So, but when you have a situation like that, if you determine the competency of both examiners, then it simply becomes a weighing of the evidence, so to speak.
Yeah,
but it's a separate aside from a competency issue.
Well, I wanted to ask about that. I sort of mentioned it to appellant's counsel, which is obviously, you know, in evidentiary terms, you've got admissibility, which is a thumbs up or thumbs down determination, and that's similar to what competency is. And then you've got the weight ascribed to given evidence, given, you know, a million factors. Obviously, competency is an issue that can be waived. You know, and if you didn't address it below, we can't do much with it here. Does it affect, though, in a sense, the probative weight of the evidence? Is that a sort of backdoor around the waiver issue?
I'm not sure if I'm understanding the court's question exactly, but
I'm sort of thinking along a civil law analog here, where you could say, you know, a person is competent under Daubert to testify, right? They can say, I'm an expert, I got my Harvard degrees and all that. They may still be wrong on the probative weight of the evidence. You know, and very often you had dueling experts and so forth. And so, you know, it's an admissibility issue. Certainly it's admissible. That's sort of a competency issue.
Well, certainly whether the examiner is competent does not necessarily mean that the examination or their opinion is adequate.
Okay,
and that
right.
would certainly need to be weighed by the board.
Right, and that's sort of my question is, I mean, in a sense, I mean, this could be to a lesser extent sort of addressed in maybe the adequacy of an opinion, or is that, do you think that that's covered by the waiver?
Well,
I mean, you know, if you would argue the reasons basis, hey, this case turned on this 1969 X-ray, we think it showed this, you know, these mistakes, and the fact that our cardiologist viewed it was one of the reasons they may have gotten it wrong.
regardless of the examiner's competence, the board is always going to have to take a look at the adequacy of the examination. So if the objection is not made as to the examiner's competence, the board must still address the adequacy of the examination.
Counsel, how would you describe the impact of M21 in light of the DAV decision by the Federal Circuit?
Well, Your Honor, it's going to be binding on the agency in terms of the adjudicators and how these processes are handled. In terms of binding law on the board, no, it is not. But certainly those operating below board level are going to be bound by its requirements.
So interpretive guidance internally?
Essentially.
Yeah. Okay.
Just following up on a conversation we were having earlier, under the manual provisions that we were discussing, would an orthopedic examination normally be performed by a non-specialist?
Yes, that would not be one of the four basic ones that are routinely going to be performed by a specialist. So it would be a specialty examination not normally conducted by a specialist.
Counsel, we have no further questions.
In conclusion, we request the court affirm the board's decision for the reasons so stated. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Odom, you have your rebuttal time. 7 minutes?
Yes.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
So getting to, Chief Judge, I heard your questions again about Justice Gorsuch and the presumption now being under attack.
Right.
And even though this court is still bound by its prior precedents in the Federal Circuit, there are three ways in this case that this court can conclude that the presumption doesn't apply. And to reiterate, that's one, there was not substantial compliance, or at least the board didn't address substantial compliance with its prior remand order, which is required under Stigall. And since this is a Stigall issue, the presumption of competency, we're not talking about competency, so the presumption of competency doesn't come into analysis. Two, the fact that the examiner signed the exam as a cardiologist raises the same type of irregularity indication as in Wise. Now, my colleague indicated that if the court were to come to that conclusion, then every case would come under fire and be exempt from the presumption because the M21 requires examiners to list their qualifications on every exam. And I just disagree with that. I think the provision to which he was referring says that every examiner has to list credentials, which could be nurse practitioner or MD, and only specialists have to – only examiners conducting specialist examinations have to list their specialty. So this wouldn't – finding that this case comes under Wise because of the facts wouldn't create an undue administrative burden on the VA, as my colleague indicated. And thirdly, because there is affirmative proof of the examiner's qualifications in this case, the presumption has no place. The whole purpose of the presumption is to protect VA from having to offer affirmative proof of an examiner's qualifications in every case. And if the examiner provides those qualifications or the VA somehow associates those with the records, there's really no place for presumption, and therefore there is no need to raise the objection below. And lastly, I just want to reiterate what's in our supplemental memorandum, which is that to the extent that the Secretary relies on Parks to say, well, this is a similar case where the court took into consideration what was the examiner's specialty and still found that an objection had to be raised, I think I disagree with that characterization of Parks as well. In the Federal Circuit's decision in Parks, it made clear that this court refused to consider information about the examiner's specialty and family practice because it wasn't in the record. It was submitted to this court in the first instance. So the examiner's specialty, the nurse practitioner's specialty in family medicine did not play into either the Federal Circuit's analysis or the CAVC's analysis at all. analysis at all, and that's why this case is distinguishable, because in this case we have record evidence of the examiner's specialty, which raised both the indication of irregularity and also put the case outside the scope of the presumption since the qualifications are already affirmatively in the record.
Ms. Odom, going back to your first reason why the presumption does not apply, not in substantial compliance with the remand order, I want to make sure I understand. The argument is that the remand order required an orthopedic examination, and this was done by a cardiologist, so your position is that it's not in substantial compliance because of that.
My position is that the board had to address whether it was in substantial compliance.
Had to address.
Right. It's my belief that it wasn't, but the board never addressed the issue in the first instance, so neither Mr. Watson nor this court can understand how the board reached that conclusion. Okay. And the fact that the remand order didn't specifically say we want an exam by an orthopedist or a neurologist isn't really relevant to this analysis. It's not like the remand order said examination and opinion regarding the spine. It specifically said orthopedic / neurological examination. And those words have to mean something. And it's up to the board to explain what they meant and whether there was substantial compliance with those words. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for very excellent arguments. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.